From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, home of the BPP Guarantee. You give us a listen, we'll give you something to think and talk about. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I am Luke Burbank. It's Tuesday, September 25th, 2007.
In Iran, we don't have homosexuals like in your country. We don't have that in our country. In Iran, we do not have this phenomenon. I don't know who's told you that we have it.
Wasn't me. I didn't tell them.
Wow.
They have it.
Ahmadinejad, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran, making a bold claim yesterday at Columbia University. Apparently he's checked, and he knows there are no gays in the nation of Iran. We will have a talk about what else he said and what the reaction was.
Also, we're going to talk about what's going on in Myanmar. You may have seen on the cover of a lot of these newspapers just pictures of monks walking silently through the city, the capital cities. There have been about 10,000 pro-democracy monks demonstrating. People are cheering them on. The military government not happy about getting involved. We'll explain what's going on over there.
Also, it's Tuesday, and that means it's time for some new music.
Woo!
There is a big old bunch of CDs. I was going to say a something load, but then I was, what can you say?
Just load? A wad.
Okay, there was a big wad of CDs coming out today. Foo Fighters.
Yay.
Also, some bands you may not have heard of, like a band we're excited about, The Weaker Than. So we're going to hear from Andy Langer, music critic at Esquire.
Think about this when you log on to Facebook today. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that Facebook may be getting a deal that could make the company worth $10 billion. Who has the deep pockets? Microsoft will explain.
And we're going to talk cricket. It is a big sport in a lot of places, not called the United States. And I, as a big sports fan, know nothing about cricket. And I'm going to get myself educated on that, and hopefully you too, as the listener. We're going to get to today's top stories from Rachel Martin in just a minute. First, though, let's get to the BPP's big story.
President Bush and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will both address the UN General Assembly today. It is unlikely, though, that they will cross paths.
Ahmadinejad's appearance at Columbia University here in New York City yesterday still has people talking. The event began with the school's president, Lee Bollinger, who had promised to deliver sharp criticism of Ahmadinejad. But I think people were still actually surprised at how sharp it was. Here's a taste.
In a December 2005 state television broadcast, you described the Holocaust as a fabricated legend. 1 year later, you held a two-day conference of Holocaust deniers. For the illiterate and ignorant, this is dangerous propaganda. You are either brazenly provocative or astonishingly uneducated.
For 10 to 12 minutes, Bollinger ripped into Ahmadinejad's positions, from human rights violations to his denials of the Holocaust. Here's how Bollinger actually wrapped the whole thing up.
I am only a professor who is also a university president. And today I feel all the weight of the modern civilized world yearning to express the revulsion at what you stand for. I only wish I could do better. Thank you.
Snap. Students we talked to, they told us the reaction to Bollinger's speech has been pretty positive among their classmates. These would be students at Columbia. Of course, this was all a prelude, though, to the main event. That was when President Ahmadinejad gave his speech. It was mainly a commentary on the nature of God, science, and wisdom, meaning the issues on the minds of most Americans weren't actually covered until the question and answer period.
Now, after chastising Bollinger for what Ahmadinejad called unfriendly treatment, he went on with his thoughts, challenging that one country shouldn't have a monopoly on nuclear weapons. Wonder who he was talking about. And then saying the Holocaust should not be treated as fact. Here's a sample.
Right now, there are a number of European academics who have been sent to prison because they attempted to write about the Holocaust or research it from a different perspective, questioning certain aspects of it. My question is, why isn't it open to all forms of research?
Coming up, we'll get more reaction to Ahmadinejad's appearance when we talk to two Columbia students. One was actually inside the auditorium for the speech. The other watched it with the crowds outside on the lawn. Now, that's the Bryant Park Project's big story for today. Let's get the rest of the news from our own Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. Good morning. So while Iran's leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was taking some heat up at Columbia University yesterday, other world leaders were talking about how to cool things down. It was the start of the UN's General Assembly, and the UN held a global summit on the environment. At issue, how countries can help stop global warming. Two big American names in the green movement headlined the event, former Vice President Al Gore and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger, who has pushed states to mandate a cap on emissions, told the audience that each leader, each country, has the responsibility to act to stop global warming. World leaders will meet in Bali this December to try to come up with a new emissions reduction plan to succeed the Kyoto Protocol in 2012. And President Bush spent some time yesterday trying to breathe some life into the Middle East peace process, which proved predictably difficult. Top-level U.S. diplomats have been talking with their Israeli and Palestinian counterparts for months, trying to hammer out the terms of a major peace conference scheduled for November. But the parties can't seem to agree on what's supposed to happen there. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and President Bush appeared before reporters after their hour-long meeting. Bush didn't mention the upcoming conference, but he did promise that Palestinian statehood is a priority for the U.S.
I believe that the vision of two states, side by side in peace, is achievable. And we want to help you realize that goal.
That wasn't enough for Abbas. He says the November conference should be the first real step to full and permanent statehood for Palestine. It's unclear just how much progress can be made at the meeting, though. The participant list is still undefined, and peace talks historically dissolve over the most contentious issues, the definition of borders, control of Jerusalem, and what to do with millions of Palestinian refugees. Union workers at General Motors returned to the picket lines today, the second day of a strike by the United Auto Workers against the car manufacturer. The strike is the first against GM in 30 years. It started late yesterday morning when 73,000 workers walked off the job. The company says it needs to reduce its $5 billion annual health care bill. The union is pushing GM to keep more jobs in the U.S. Talks between the union and GM continue today. More on this story coming up later in the show. And if you're a history buff who's, for some reason, always wanted your very own copy of the Magna Carta, well, now you have a chance. A privately owned 13th century copy of the historic document is going up for sale. Sotheby's Auction House is expected to make the formal announcement today. The Magna Carta is hailed as the milestone of English freedom, and America's founding fathers borrowed heavily from the document when they drafted the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. Bill of Rights. Sotheby's estimates that the one-page document, written in Latin, will fetch about $20 to $30 million. It's the only copy of the Magna Carta in the U.S., previously on display at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Sotheby's says there are 16 other copies of the Magna Carta in Britain and Australia. The news is always online at npr.org. I'm Rachel Martin. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
I'm so glad you said it was Sotheby's and not eBay. I got really worried when I heard you were doing that story.
That would have really signaled yet a further turn
the
down
end,
the
end of times.
Down the wrong path for humankind.
Thanks, Rachel.
You're welcome.
Well, for the first time in 31 years, the United Auto Workers have called a national strike. 73,000 members walked off the job yesterday after the union and General Motors failed to reach an agreement on benefits and job security. Joining us now from Michigan to kind of lay things out is Dustin Dwyer. He's a reporter from Michigan Radio. Hi, Dustin.
How's it going?
Good. So both sides stand to lose some money in the short term because of this strike, and both of them, I've been reading, said they really wanted to avoid it. Was this a surprise?
It was a huge surprise. People around here, no one really expected this. There were analysts talking about this. You know, they've been talking since July, and we've been talking about it even before then. Everyone was sort of building this negotiating session up, and no one thought there would be a strike. Analysts said no chance of a strike. Both sides see this as mutually assured destruction. GM can't afford it. The UAW can't afford it. And so leading up until Sunday, everyone said no strike is possible. And then Sunday night, the UAW came out and suddenly said, you know, after all these reports had said that the talks were kind of going okay, they had agreed to the fundamentals on some issues, and then suddenly there was a statement out from the UAW that they were shocked that GM wasn't doing more to protect workers and to do more on job security. They set a firm deadline, 11 a.m. yesterday morning, and they walked right up to that deadline. They called the strike at 11 o'clock.
In essence, what is the union's beef, Dustin?
Well, We don't know the specifics of their beef. They won't tell us the specific issues, but in essence, it's about job security. Yesterday, the president of the UAW, Ron Gettelfinger, he held a press conference, and he said, you know, this is about job security, and when you say job security, you're talking about investment in plants, future investment in plants. You know, GM has closed a bunch of plants in the past couple of years as part of its restructuring plan. So the UAW wants guarantees, saying, you know, if we're going to help you out on you know, certain cost issues, we want to guarantee that these plants are going to be around and that these people are not going to lose jobs.
How big of a deal is health care? Because that's something that costs GM, you know, so much money, and that they say that's part of the why they're losing money.
Yeah, GM spent $4.8 billion on healthcare last year, and GM only lost $2 billion.
That's almost enough to buy Facebook.
Yeah,
it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and so GM's trying to get that cost down. There's this plan on the table for GM to set up a trust fund that the UAW would then manage, and it would get healthcare completely off GM's books. But that's not the problem, at least according to the UAW president, Ron Gettelfinger, yesterday. He said we're okay with the trust fund. This strike is not about health care. It's not about that fund. It's about economic issues. It's about job security.
Dustin, who do you think this hurts more?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it sort of depends on how it shakes out. I mean, GM is in a position now where it can withstand a strike a little bit better than it could last year, for example. The year before, GM was still in the middle of its restructuring. It hadn't seen any sort of turnaround on its planet. GM lost $10 billion in 2005. It lost $2 billion in 2006. So it's starting to improve, and GM is starting to get better numbers. Sales are starting to pick up just a little bit. And so GM has more cash on hand. You know, some analysts say they can last about, you know, several weeks perhaps, but not much longer. The UAW has plenty of money in its strike fund right now to pay for workers who are off the line.
Well, plenty of money, although, as we're about to find out with our next guest, people aren't going to be getting rich as they work the strike line. Listen, Dustin Dwyer from Michigan Radio, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Let's bring in someone from the UAW right now. Mike O'Rourke is president of UAW Local 1853 in Spring Hill, Tennessee. That's where they build the Saturn Ion and the Saturn View. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Did you get any sleep last night?
No, we've been up all night.
You sound tired, sir.
Yeah. Last night when I talked to you, you said I might be grumpy tomorrow because I'm not going to get any sleep. Are you feeling grumpy today?
No, I'm not feeling grumpy at all. I'm in a good mood.
Just kind of in brief, how do you feel GM is treating your union unfairly?
Well, I think, as your past guest said, it's, you know, one of the major issues is job security. And our leaders are fighting job security for our members throughout the country. And it's a very, you know, in our plant right now, we're down right now. We have an empty plant. And, you know, with our members, job security is a huge issue.
Well, this is the thing that I'm kind of wondering about. Let's say that you guys actually stay out for a long time and you actually sort of hurt GM's productivity. Maybe you get what you want, but you've sort of further wounded financially this company that's already in kind of bad shape. How do you win in that case?
You know, I don't think this isn't about hurting either side. It's about getting both sides to the table and bargaining in a fair manner. And our leadership thought that the talks were not progressing at the pace that they felt they should. And, you know, they're trying to expedite these talks.
Mike, we heard the reporter there to say that GM, they can stay on the strike for a couple of weeks, that they've got enough money to do so. How about you and the folks you work with? I understand you're getting, about $200 a week in terms of strike pay?
That's correct. We get $200 a week for our strike pay.
How are you going to fare? What do you think?
How does somebody live on that?
What we'll do is if we get some people that are in rough shape, we'll talk to their creditors, we'll have food drives, we'll do everything we can do to keep our members sustained.
Mike,
we've already been, you know, getting some donations. The community has actually in the first 20 hours has been very supportive.
Mike O'Rourke, president of UAW Local 1853 in Spring Hill, Tennessee. Get some sleep, man.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, we're going to talk new music. Lots of CDs coming out today.
I actually already downloaded the Foo Fighters.
I know. I can always tell the musical selection that you're particularly excited. Last week it was the Donnas. This week it's Foo Fighters.
I just like to rock it out before 9 a.m. Also, what started out as a protest over fuel prices has grown into a pro-democracy movement in Myanmar. We'll get you the details and explain what's going on in that Asian country. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Hopefully you're getting your groove on while you're listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Don't hurt yourself, though.
Yeah,
okay?
Exactly.
Shake
it. Shake it. Don't break it.
The listeners we can get. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. Well, we've reached that point in the show where we like to give you a little something-something. Some news you can probably use, or maybe you can't, but we know you're going to dig it, and it's called The Ramble. A study conducted in Canada shows now that women are apparently more attracted to men with deep voices. They found that the men sounded older, healthier, and more masculine. Case in point.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby.
Oh, the walrus of love.
Oh, baby.
You were taken too quickly from us. On the flip side, by the way, they also found that men tend to go for high-pitched voiced women. They found those women to be more attractive, more subordinate. That's kind of disturbing. And younger sounding.
But Barry White had 8 kids.
Yeah,
Justin
exactly.
Timberlake, none.
That's right. It would explain the attraction of Bernadette Peters. My darling, I
can't get enough of your love, babe. 8 kids he knows of, and many more he's responsible for because of that song.
Why don't we just play music on this show? It's always the best part.
Let's check out a story out of Oregon. A family name apparently has become offensive on a license plate. This nice family, the Udink family, they had license plates. It said Udinks 1. They had 2 specialized plates for more than 5 years. They went in to get a 3rd last summer, and the DMV said no, that Udink is a slur of some sort. So, of course, we went to UrbanDictionary.com. I've heard dink used as, you're a jerk, you're such a dink, you
right.
Dink. But apparently, it's also a slur against Vietnamese people. So that is probably the slur they're concerned about, although I've also heard people use it to describe the male anatomy in some ways.
There is a London-based company called Ad Air. They have decided to start placing billboard ads that will be visible to plane passengers as they land near LAX. The ads are going to be placed at a dozen major airports, actually, including LAX, London Heathrow, Paris, Charles de Gaulle. The first site goes into Dubai International Airport, like everything else that's cool. It's always Dubai, like of all places. They're always at the vanguard of this stuff.
They have a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. but this is not exactly a new concept. I mean, this is sort of just the next step after they started putting those ads so that people could Google Earth them.
Yeah.
This just seems like a lot.
So, I mean, I'm on a plane, I look out my window, and it says Denny's, you know, eggs over my hammy,
right.
$9.99 or
yeah,
whatever
exactly.
on the side of the airplane.
Yeah, when you land, please visit us at the Denny's on Century Boulevard. Or Hollywood Park Casino, by the way, the Inglewood's finest casino. They have an awesome roof sign, which I have many times admired from the plane landing in LAX.
And then gone directly there.
I'm not here to talk about that, Allison.
That's the ramble for this Tuesday.
Could have happened. It's possible.
About a month ago, the government of Myanmar raised the price of fuel by 5 times. People took to the street to protest, and the militarily run government did not take too kindly to that kind of activity. Enter the monks. You may have seen these pictures in the paper. They're really incredible. Thousands of monks just walking silently to protest the current rule. Now, the military officers who rule the country have warned demonstrators to go home and face consequences. Well, today the monks are back on the street, as many as 10,000, continuing on what's considered the biggest protest there in 20 years. And apparently armed riot police have been deployed to the area to disperse the protesters. To learn a little bit more about this, we turn now to Burmese American who's in close contact with the protesters. Of course, Myanmar was formerly known as Burma. Nyant Tan is president of the Burmese American Democratic Alliance, a pro-democracy group. He's joining us now from California. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you explain to us why the monks have played such an important role in these protests? How are they viewed in society there?
Yeah, let me give you some brief background of these protests, right? There's a three-part in this. Initially, because of the fuel price hike, the activist-led protests occurred. During the period, the activists were arrested and cracked down using the street thugs. So monks who are entirely depending on the public, who has been suffering for 20 years, and also seeing those kinds of brutal protests, you know, alarm them to take part, but in smaller number. But on this September 5th, the monks were arrested in Bokoku and insulted. The trigger is another level of, you know, response from the monk. So monk calling the apology from the government by September 17th. But they are protesting then in a smaller number. September 18 is also a 90th anniversary of the military coup in Burma, crushing the 1988 broke democracy uprising. So the government did not respond to the apology request. Then the monk basically stepped up and protested in many cities in Rangoon in larger numbers, up to 20,000. So then the public still didn't involve. So by September 24, the monk issued another statement calling for the public to join hands. And yesterday and today, we are seeing the public has answered their call loud and clear, up to 100,000 taking to the streets along with the monks.
Now, the monks have been chanting, "It's our task," and chanting the word democracy. Is it the monks' task to join and help with civil protest?
No, I think the monk has never been involved in the, you know, protests like this in Burma, never. And, you know, the only time is in 1988 when they see public are being killed on the streets.
There were about 3,000 people killed in 1988 in those protests, right?
Yes, only that time the monks took to the streets, but they were cracked down as well. But since then, the public has been suffering a lot. So now people are fear, you know, people have overcome the fear and taken to the streets. And the monks who are survive only by the donations and support by the people, when people are suffered, they suffer too. And also, you know, every day they are being oppressed. Many senior monks have been jailed for a long time, you know. So because of all so many years of oppressions and, you know, the suffering people are facing, they want to help the people. But this is not their role. And as you said, that the protests are now becoming more and more political. Previously, the monk took to the street only citing the, you know, Metta Sutta. It's a loving kindness, because there ought to be a love between the ruler and the people.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are chanting democracy and waving the flags.
Let me get your opinion on something. There's word today that the United States President, Mr. Bush, will urge new sanctions against the military junta that rules in Myanmar, Burma, when he speaks to the UN General Assembly. assembly today. Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it will have any effect, sanctions?
Yes, I think the United States has imposed sanctions, has been imposing very strong sanctions. But because of the China, India, and the neighboring country, you know, they support Burma politically, economically, and, you know, and many militarily. So because of their support, Burmese government has been withstanding Western pressure, United States sanctions, and survived to these days. But now I think United States is stepping up further. And also China, which has been defending politically at the UN Security Council, they might be having second thought because they are shooting for their 2008 Olympic, and they don't want, you know, something like this happening in their next door neighbor. So they are even voicing, you know, they want their national reconciliation in Burma. This is a different from what they has been saying a long time. So I think stepping up by the United States is a very good effort this time. And I think China, Russia, and India, countries like this, when they are seeing that many number of people taking to the streets, they will have second thought and they might change their mind. So I hope UN Security Council, United Nations, will step up and do a swift and effective measures, you know, to prevent the bloodshed in Burma.
And help out. Nguyen Tan is the president of the Burmese American Democratic Alliance, a pro-democracy group. Thank you so much for walking us through this story. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's Tuesday. That means the day that I blow my lunch money on new CDs, or more to the point, new downloads from iTunes.
I've already been on. I've been on 4 a.m. downloading my little heart out. It's a big release date today, maybe the last big release date until 2008. Andy Langer is here to help us sift through the mammoth list of releases that hit iTunes and the shelves of record stores, if you still go there. Hey, Andy.
It is a good morning for music.
Yeah, you are going to be very busy. By the way, I'll just give you a little, you are the music critic for Esquire magazine. Just got to throw that in there.
All right.
So maybe one of the bigger name bands to drop something today, the Foo Fighters.
Yay!
I don't know if it's clear enough that Allison enjoys this musical act. Their new record's called Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. And let's just hear a little bit of this track. It's called Statues. This is off their new record.
Got by, though we never needed much. A sliver of hope, no diamond rings. We got high, it was heaven, it was hell. Fly over them with broken wings. We're just ordinary people.
Wow, a little Beatles-y, a little, maybe even a little dash of the Shins. This sounds kind of different from some of their other records.
I mean, if anything on the latest Paul McCartney record was as good as that, we would have all been at Starbucks at 7 a.m. that record day of. The Foo Fighters, I mean, are dependable. The record is complex and challenging. I mean, but at the core, the Foo Fighters are a pop band, and that is maybe their finest pop song yet, just a pure Beatles-esque pop song. It's real simple, and yet, you know, I think they've gone this long with a lot of anthems, a lot of great radio songs, but this is one of those sort of timeless pop songs that makes an album, and that sitting there in the middle of this record makes this record maybe better than the last couple Foo Fighters records, which have all been really good.
Okay, I'm going to ask a question which might sound a little bit ageist. You know, Dave Grohl, no youngster. I mean, he's almost as old as I am.
Former member of Nirvana.
Yeah, and I'm wondering how it is he stays relevant in the world of Fall Out Boy and the like.
Well, you know, Grohl takes a shot at the Fall Out Boys and the like with a song called Cheer Up, Boys, Your Makeup is Running.
No, you didn't, David.
I'm not sure he's looking for friends with those folks or cred with those kinds of fans. But, I mean, here's a guy who is one of two people left on the planet that knows what it is to have been in Nirvana and is very relevant, A, because he is one of those two guys, and B, he just keeps growing and growing and being the kind of guy who isn't afraid to poke fun at himself, to write real, simple, straightforward pop songs. And I don't think, you know, there's anything timely about the Foo Fighters, which makes them sort of timeless. And Grohl is still a great rock star. I mean, you go see the Foo Fighters, you're going to get your money's worth. I mean, I'm not sure that other than Wayne Coyne of the Flaming Lips, there's a better rock star out there today, a guy that more people want to be entertained by than Dave Grohl.
Let's take a listen to something that's entirely different. You want to get on your groove shoes and swing it on back to the 1940s. Willie Nelson's sister has put out a record. Her name's Bobby Nelson. It's called Audio Biography. Let's take a listen to some of her solo work. She's a piano player. This is called Pine Top Boogie, I believe. So, Andy, why haven't we heard from Bobby Nelson before, the brother who everybody knows, Willie?
Well, if you've seen Willie's tour schedule and Bobby Nelson's been sitting next to him for 35 years, who's got time to make a solo record when you got to go everywhere Willie goes? And she is, you know, the core of the family. When you talk Willie and the family, that's Bobby Nelson, 76 years old, sitting next to Willie every day for the last 35 years. And somebody said to her, why don't you write a book? And she said, I wouldn't write a book. You know, my story's told through music. And they said, well, why don't you make a solo record? And this is it. I mean, it's a collection of songs that inspired her back in the day. And that Pine Tops Boogie, you know, that was a hit in the 30s from, you know, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Fats Waltz. You know, they've all taken on that song. That's how she heard it on an AM radio back when. And she's sitting there at a solo acoustic piano just banging out these classic boogies.
There's something so cool about the fact that she was around when this stuff, and it's not just some 20-year-old kid, you know, who's sort of revisiting that, but like she lived this.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's definitely that authenticity factor that you're right, some 20-year-old kid just simply couldn't have. And, you know, makes two cameos on the record, opens and closes the record with her, but it's really about her and the piano. And this is, you know, it's just a great mood record. It's a record that you could put on pretty much in any situation and find something there that moves you somehow.
Well, let's move on to a band that has no 70-year-olds in it. I don't think, anyway. I haven't actually run their background.
I'll Google that for you.
I'm gonna assume the Weaker Thans don't have any. Is that septuagenarians? Is that 70? The Weaker Thans. They have a new album out. It's called Reunion Tour. Let's hear a track off of that.
My confusion corner commuters are cursing the cold away as December tries to dissemble the length of their working day, and they bite their mitts off to show me transfers, deposit change, and I can't stop finding your face in their faces all rearranged.
It's like Weird Al Yankovic's prog rock band. You like these guys, though.
I really do. I think that if you like, you know, Bright Eyes, the Mountain Goats, John Vanderslice, the Decemberists, any of those sort of, you know, bands for people that have graduate college degrees, if you like those bands, this is a better band than those because they have a sense of depth and melody that I don't think any of those have yet come close to achieving. And, you know, they're a band from Winnipeg, Canada. They don't get a lot of attention over here. Classic big in Canada syndrome. But really smart, really literate. And this album sounds really wintry. it's a winter record. It's a record that just has a warmth that you could crawl into bed with the lyric book to this record and sort of put yourself to sleep reading along with this record.
I just have to say, in the notes here, I saw that you mentioned to one of our producers a Canadian version of The Hold Steady, only better. How dare you, sir? Hold Steady, friend of this program. But anyway, I'm sorry. Moving on, Allison.
There's a new e-single out by The Roots. Explain the backstory to this first quickly.
Well, apparently The Roots had an extra song laying around, as bands are able to do. You know, it came from their last sessions for the Game Theory record, which was, by any standards of hip-hop, a flop record. You know, it's the Roots record that the least people seem to enjoy. And there was an extra song laying around from those sessions that Apple ended up licensing to put into a piece of software that they've got out there. I'm not sure what the name of that software is, but there's a new piece of Apple software. I believe, actually, it's called the Logic Audio Recording Suite. And they licensed this song and then put it up on iTunes as a, quote, e-single.
Let's take a listen to it real quick so people know what we're talking about. This is The Roots, their new e-single, Marathon Man.
Marathon Man, your regular Mr. Marathon Man. Running this race as fast as I can. Can't wait to get that thing in my hand and I'm gone. Yeah, I'm gone. I'm just a marathon man. Your regular Mr. Marathon Man. Running this race as fast as I can. Can't wait.
So, Andy, something like this, I mean, does it get released to hot hit radio or is it just out there for Roots fans?
I think this is out there for Roots fans or anybody that's sort of tooling around iTunes looking at the latest hip-hop releases. I mean, that's how I found it. And nobody knew it's out there because it got released on 9/11, the day of the big 50 versus Kanye debate.
Ah, yes.
No one was thinking Roots on 9/11.
Poor Philadelphia Roots.
Illadelph, represent for the 215.
Well, we're giving them their due today. Hey, Andy Langer, music critic for Esquire magazine. Thanks for walking us through some of the new releases today.
You got it. Have a good one.
So what do you like, Luke? The Roots, Weaker Thans, Bobby Nelson, Foo Fighters, what do you think?
I liked that Foo Fighters song a lot, and I'm actually kind of so-so on them, so that's cool. And I like this song. Weaker Thans, I don't know.
Weaker is the part you
kind
think?
Kind of weaker than
I think
bands
I'd like
that are good.
To investigate them a little bit more. I kind of like them.
All right, well, coming up, and I think this is the perfect soundtrack for the old English sport of cricket. we're going to talk about cricket coming up on the show. It's kind of like baseball, but way more confusing. We'll try to get to the bottom of that.
Microsoft is trying to friend Facebook. Could $300 million do it? Maybe. Only a maybe. And we'll explain why. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. It's like a Mack truck with a madman behind a wheel is ill. When you're feeling like part of a man and you're standing on stage with your heart in your hand and you coming from the muscle, ain't thought of a plan, and you a day late and bought a buck short of a scam. It feel like more than sort of a jam. Yeah, I'm just a marathon man, your regular Mr. Marathon Man.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are always available for your listening pleasure online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Coming up, Microsoft pokes Facebook. That always sounds vaguely dirty. But first, let's hear about today's top news stories from Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Protests are expected again today in New York as Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad prepares to speak at the UN's General Assembly. Yesterday, the Iranian leader was the guest speaker at Columbia University, where students gathered to voice their opposition to his visit. They railed against Ahmadinejad's denial of the Holocaust and Iran's record on human rights. This is how Columbia University's President Lee Bollinger addressed Ahmadinejad on stage at the event yesterday.
Mr. President, you exhibit all the signs of a petty and cruel dictator.
Ahmadinejad responded that this was no way to treat a guest. During questions from the audience, he reiterated his doubts that the Holocaust even happened. And when asked about his government's treatment of homosexuals, he said there are no homosexuals in Iran. For the first time in more than 30 years, an American power company is asking permission to build nuclear power plants. The company NRG Energy, based in New Jersey, is applying for a license from the federal government to start work on two nuclear facilities in Texas. It's a move that experts say signals a revived interest in nuclear power, spurred by high prices for natural gas, high demand for electricity, and the desire for more American independence, from oil. And imagine someone giving you $500,000, no strings attached, and calling you a genius for all the ways you've helped make the world a better place. That's the basis of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation grants, and this year's winners were announced today at 12:01 a.m. Among this year's 24 honorees, a forensic anthropologist, a medieval historian, a spider silk biologist, who knows what that is, and a blues and reggae musician from Virginia. Corey Harris, who according to the Foundation's website has spent his career exploring the historical and cultural conditions that gave rise to the blues and telling stories through jazz, gospel, folk, and reggae. Since 1981, the Foundation has named 756 fellows. The money is awarded to help them continue their work, but there are no expectations for how they can use it. That's the news. I'm Rachel Martin. Luke and Allison, back to you.
Thank you, Rachel.
And that's why those grants are genius. You don't have to do anything with it except
no strings.
You could go out and be creative and
go on a big shopping spree if you want.
I mean, what would a reggae historian do with all that money and all that time?
How big would the fatty be? That's what you're trying to say.
I was trying to be delicate about it, Allison, but okay. You took it there. Wow,
you know
that was the shortest reggae song in history.
It's early. You can't be that delicate when it's this early. So Microsoft tried to friend Facebook yesterday, reportedly offering to lay down $300 to $500 million for a 5% stake in Facebook. So why? Well, the online social networking site has about 40 million members at this point. And a deal like this could actually push Facebook's value to $10 billion. But Microsoft isn't the only one trying to write on Facebook's wall. Google may try to get on the act as well, but hold on a minute. Facebook may decide it's not up for grabs. Dennis Berman is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, where this article was printed. Hey, Dennis, how are you?
Good morning to you. The Roots are better than Corey Harris. They so are.
Okay, we'll have you on next week
put,
as our music
sir.
Reporter. aside from cachet, why would Microsoft pursue this deal? What advantages does it give the company to have a 5% stake in Facebook?
Well, Microsoft is desperate. It's been desperate for years to make inroads into the internet economy and the world that the internet has created. And they're sort of the rich uncle who tries to buy his way into the cool party. And so 5% stake would align Facebook's interests with Microsoft, and Microsoft would continue serving its ads as it does today. And you'd presumably see all sorts of things that would link you to MSN and the various Microsoft sites.
So does Facebook need this kind of money to keep up its growth? They have about 300 people who work there. Is that a reason they'd get involved in this, just simply money?
The history of these social networking sites, if you go way back, and you may remember, Allison, back GeoCities and those sorts of sites back 10 years ago, they really do require capital to continue innovation because there's so much competition on the internet. So, yes, capital is good. It helps you pay for that innovation. But do you really want to align yourself with Microsoft? It's a tough question. That said, getting a $10 billion valuation, sort of nailing that down, saying, hey, my company's worth $10 billion, is an awfully nice thing, too.
I have actually interviewed Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, CEO. He's 23. This guy's a real maverick. I can actually see him just kind of turning up his nose at money and saying, that's not really what I'm in this for. He has his own ideas about what Facebook should be. Do you think that Zuckerberg is a player in this in terms of his personality?
Oh, he's certainly a big player, and personality as it comes to mesh with Microsoft is a big question for him. But to turn down money and turn down investment, be it from Microsoft or anyone else, may not be the best thing. Rupert Murdoch, who bought my parent company, News Corporation, he put it quite well. He said the first road to viability, or the first road to freedom is viability. I messed up that quote. But he's right. To be able to sustain yourself, create a profit, means you can grow and innovate. And if you don't have the capital to do that, you impinge on your ability to really change and make things better.
Who else is courting Facebook at this point?
Google's in the mix, and you can bet every venture capitalist and private equity firm in California and Silicon Valley is courting Zuckerberg and saying, hey, take our money, do with it as you please. We just want to be part of what you're doing. But Microsoft is so desperate that it's willing to come in at a very high valuation. If someone said to you, Allison, hey, I love your apartment, let me just give you a little bit of money, and you can have, or I'll have 2, 3, 4% of your apartment, it's not a terrible offer.
And it's a lovely apartment if you've actually seen it. I watched The Sopranos final there. Hey, we talked on this show recently about the kind of division between Facebook and MySpace. This kind of Facebook has emerged, at least in some people's minds, as kind of the classier site, because it started out as a sort of college thing, and MySpace has lots of flashy lights and banners and music playing automatically when you fire it up. As I understand it, maybe I'm wrong, there are far more users of MySpace. Why is it? What is it about Facebook? Is it the cachet that you're reaching all these kind of highbrow smart people? Why are they willing to pay so much money for something that has fewer users?
Well, I guess the real interest is about the quality of the time spent on the site. So people go to Facebook and they make it sort of their first stop every day. It's their organizing principle. Everything on the internet in some ways has returned back to the past. So remember the battle for the portal, the battle for the homepage. What was going to be on your homepage? Was it going to be Google? Was it going to be Yahoo? If in the morning the first thing you do is log on to your Facebook and you organize your digital life through Facebook, there's real value there, at least presumably. The real interesting thing about Facebook is that right now it doesn't make much of a profit, maybe $30 million, and much of that money is coming from guarantees by Microsoft already. So it's kind of unprofitable for all those people doing all those things online. It's still not much of a business venture. So to award a $10 billion valuation, a $13 billion valuation, is pretty darn incredible.
You made a mention there that Microsoft and Facebook already have some sort of relationship. Can you explain that?
Microsoft guarantees a certain amount of revenue each year to Facebook, and for that right, Microsoft places ads via its technology and its network on Facebook. So Facebook doesn't have its own advertising sales force. It sort of outsourced it to Microsoft.
Do you have a Facebook account?
I do not. I'm too busy to have a Facebook account. And that's an interesting point about Facebook and MySpace. Facebook obviously opened up its service to non-college people, to the world at large, and that's been a pretty good move for it. But as people get older, they just have less time to do the things on Facebook as much as college kids do. So that's when I was talking to people preparing the column that I wrote today, that's one of the concerns they had, which is the core audience is young people, and those young people actually have less disposable income than the people you really want to reach, at least from an advertiser standpoint. Those are people in their late 20s and their 30s.
Dennis Berman, a reporter with The Wall Street Journal, thanks for waking up early and joining us.
I'm going to go buy that Roots album right now.
Happy downloading, right. Dennis.
Bye.
All right, as has been established now on this very program, I am a big sports fan.
Huge.
I was watching competitive Scrabble a few weekends ago when I was in L.A. I will watch anything that has some sort of competitive element to it. But even I have no idea what this guy is talking about.
The final margin was just 5 runs, with Pakistan losing their final wicket of the excellent Misbah-ul-Haq for 43, with just 3 balls remaining.
Jigga wall?
It was a sticky wicket too, I believe.
Yeah, I from what I've been able to piece together, that's a BBC post-game report on what was actually a giant sports event outside of the U.S., that is. It was the Cricket 20 World Cup. And from what I gather, India won on Sunday, and it was, again, a very big deal.
It was a huge deal. If you went to Google Trends yesterday, out of the top 20, it was India, wicket, cricket, top 20. I mean, people were searching. Clearly, people in India and Pakistan and other parts that care about cricket.
Yeah, a lot of them. A lot of them. But we kind of know nothing about this, and I wanted to find out more. I'm always into adopting a new sport. So here to try to help unravel this for us a little bit is Vivek Agastya. He's a banker with Credit Suisse by day, but a cricket super fan by night. And he is here to talk to us about it. Vivek, thanks for coming on.
No problem, man. I'm always glad to try and convert some more people into cricket.
Nice.
Okay, before we actually get into the mechanics of how cricket works, why was this win by India yesterday a big deal?
Australia have been the dominant force in cricket now for, what, eight, 9 years? They won pretty much
8, 9
yeah,
years.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Everything there is. And this is the first time that they had been dethroned. They didn't even make it to the finals of this event. So that's one of the reasons that the rest of the cricketing world is heaving a sigh. You know, that team can actually be beat. So that was huge. The second thing was, this is a new format to the game. Cricket was traditionally played over 5 days. This was a 21st century form of the game where it's played over 3 hours.
Wait, would one game go 5 days?
Uh-huh. One game goes 5 days. And back in the old days, they sometimes didn't even have results at the end of that.
Wow. You just wonder why it never caught on in the U.S. It sounds scintillating. Okay, how many games did you watch in this, what's it called, World 20?
The 2020 World Cup, I only managed to catch 4 games.
So that's like, what, a month? This was the shorter one.
Each of these games are only 3 hours long.
Okay.
So I managed to get 4 of them, but, you know, since you mentioned where I work, I can't admit to more than that.
Vivek, you. So are a lot of these games on in the middle of the night?
When I was back at school, I used to watch these things. I used to sit up all night and watch these. I'm a big fan of the Indian cricket team because I'm Indian. And I'd stay up for 8 hours, 10 hours every night and watch the game. And then I'd go to school during the day. That was doable then. It's a little tougher now since I work and I'm expected to pull in quite a few hours. So I wake up a few times in the night and I'll watch, you know, check the scores out and watch parts of matches.
I need to know more. I need to know how you play this game.
Okay. Let's try to break this down. From what I could gather on Wikipedia, it's sort of like baseball, although actually I guess baseball is probably more like cricket because cricket is much, much older. And there's a guy who stands with a bat. He's kind of like a baseball hitter, and a guy who pitches it to him, sort of like a baseball pitcher. But then things get kind of crazy. Can you explain it for us, Vivek?
Sure. How long do I have?
4 minutes and 53 seconds.
Well, it's a five-day-long game, yeah. You give me 4 minutes to explain it?
You know what? Every second you protest is less time you have to explain your beloved sport, bro.
All right, here I go. Well, cricket's very similar to baseball, yeah? So you've got the fielding team that tries and gets the batters out, mm-hmm. and you've got a batting team that tries and scores as many runs as it can. Now, the key difference, though, is that each team only has one innings. So the first team goes in and sets a target number of runs, and the second one then tries and comes and beats that number.
I see.
Another key difference is that each batter keeps batting till he gets out. And that's one of the reasons that I love cricket more than I like baseball. I love baseball.
You just get to keep hitting it and hitting it and hitting it.
Until you
or
get
attempting
out.
It.
Until you get out.
My kind of game.
Now the ball
I'd be there for days.
The ball that the guy throws is much harder than a baseball, right?
It is. It's made of leather. And back in the old days when there wasn't much gear, quite a few people used to get hurt.
Yeah, because I was. It looks like it's like a little, you know, cannonball or something. Do they catch it in the air with their bare hands?
Yeah, they do. They do. The first time I caught one when I was a kid, my hand zinged for a day or two.
Yeah, and a love affair was born. Okay,
that
so,
it was.
So there aren't bases, though, in the tradition. Like, there's not a diamond of bases like there is in baseball. These guys just run back and forth from one sort of hitting area to the next?
Yeah, so the batter stands, the home plate, as you might call it, is in the middle of a large oval circle.
Uh-huh.
So the batter stands in the middle, and he can hit the ball anywhere, including behind him.
Ooh,
and
sneaky.
He doesn't run in over the diamond. What he runs is from the home plate to the pitcher's mound and back. Each length that he runs is one run. So you hit the ball, and you run as many times between these two points as you can without getting tagged out, or run out, as we call it in cricket.
Do they have – is there like the equivalent of baseball where a guy stands at one of the sort of bases, and if the ball is thrown to him before the batter gets there, he's out too?
Yeah, that's – except that what you have is you have wooden furniture. You call it the wicket. There's three sticks standing out of the ground.
Oh, right.
Those need to be hit rather than the base or the player being tagged. But, and, yeah, effectively it's the same thing.
And these guys throw this ball – what do you call the guy who pitches it?
We call him a bowler.
The bowlers will bowl this ball really fast, right?
Not quite as fast as baseball, actually. They get into the 90s, the 90 miles per hour range.
All.
And the reason for that is one of the rules of cricket says that you can't bend your elbow when you bowl it. So they come running from really far away, and they have to bowl it, you know, with a straight arm action.
That's why they get that really kind of, I would say, funky-looking kind of posture, but I guess it's just part of the deal. You run and you kind of have your arm straight and you fling it.
Hurl it.
You kind of hurl it. Okay, well, listen, do you think that cricket will ever catch on with Americans like me, people that don't really hail from the UK or from some other place where cricket is big? Or is this just going to be something for the cricket devotees?
No, I think it's going to catch on. I think you have a lot more immigrants coming into this country now that follow the game, that pass it on. I've got an Irish-American colleague that followed the World Cup with me. Right next to me. So I think it's picking on. And I think this new format, the 2020 format, which only lasts 3 hours, it's built for television and it's built for the American audience. I think it's going to pick on here.
Well, listen, if there was anyone who could make the case, Vivek, I think it was you. Thank you for coming on. And Vivek Agustia, we won't blow your cover at Credit Suisse, although I guess we already did. But, you know, we'll leave it alone in terms of what you're doing in the daytime online at work. Listen, thanks for coming on the show, Vivek.
Thanks, guys. Glad to be on, and I hope I converted at least one person. Yeah.
Okay.
You know it's going to be big on ESPN 9. All the time. Puma's got a whole cricket line.
The
CFA? So does Adidas. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, although I have to say the fashion in cricket is awesome.
Yeah.
They get to wear these cool, like, white stuff. It's very...
It could catch on. I don't know. He kind of had me.
Yeah.
He had me at the wicket.
Coming up, we're going to talk about a GOP debate that's coming up later this week. The only catch is that none of the top-tier candidates are going to show up, and we're wondering if that means they don't care about African-American voters. We'll ask someone.
You're listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. It's Tuesday, September 25th, 2007. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart, one of your helpful tour guides to the news and information of the day. And one of the big stories of the day, I don't know if you heard this, but the Iranian president spoke at Columbia.
I heard something about that.
Yeah, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad taking some criticism yesterday at Columbia, and he wasn't really all that pleased with the reception he got.
I should not begin by being affected by this unfriendly treatment. I will tell you what I have to say, and then the questions he can raise, and I'll be happy to provide answers.
It was kind of weird, though, because they invited him there, and then before they actually let him speak, they spent about 10 minutes just totally dissing him.
Yeah, basically saying, you're the devil and you're here. But we'll let you speak for the next 50 minutes. We're going to talk to a couple of students who were actually at the event, one who was inside the auditorium and one who watched it from the lawn with a bunch of other students.
They're supposed to be here already, but being college students and it being 8 in the morning,
we'll see if they make it.
I think we should have seen that one coming.
Yeah, right. We're gonna talk about a debate, too, that's scheduled for later this week. It's a GOP debate. It's aimed at reaching African-American voters. The problem is that a lot of the candidates, top-line candidates anyways, have said that their day planner's a little full. They can't make it. We're going to ask what that means.
Also, we're going to talk about campaign logo design. What color choice, font size, what it says about the candidate, and how it can really affect a campaign.
Also, the ultimate shotgun wedding. A guy takes his lady to the park, proposes on bended knee, and they get robbed. We're going to bring them into the studios and actually find out how it went down.
All right. All that's coming up. But now, first, here's the Bryant Park Project big story of the day.
President Bush and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, they both addressed the UN General Assembly today. They won't cross paths, though. In fact, President Bush isn't expected to say much about Iran or its president at all. He's going to focus more on Myanmar.
But, of course, people still talking about Ahmadinejad's appearance at Columbia yesterday. Now, what's getting some of the most attention is the statement by the Iranian president regarding the lack of homosexuals in Iran. Take a listen.
In Iran, we don't have homosexuals like in your country. We don't have that in our country. In Iran, we do not have this phenomenon. I don't know who's told you that we have it.
That comment may seem kind of worthy of laughter to some, but it was not that funny to gay Iranian expats who've been forced to leave their homeland because of what they say is persecution. Arsham Parsi from the Toronto-based Iranian Queer Organization, he says he had to flee Iran in 2005 to escape arrest. He had a question for Ahmadinejad yesterday saying, quote, who am I if we don't have any queers in Iran?
Also getting attention was the president of Columbia, Lee Bollinger. He had promised to provide a strong rebuke in advance of the Iranian president's remarks, and it seems a lot of people were surprised at just how strong that rebuke was.
We at this university have not been shy to protest the challenge and challenge the failures of our own government to live by our values, and we won't be shy about criticizing yours. Let's then be clear at the beginning. Mr. President, you exhibit all the signs of a petty and cruel dictator.
Coming from an Ivy League university president, that's a sort of a glove slap to the face. And Bollinger, he finished up this way.
I am only a professor who is also a university president. And today I feel all the weight of the modern civilized world yearning to express the revulsion at what you stand for. I only wish I could do better. Thank you.
The New York Times City Room blog reports mixed reaction to President Bollinger's speech, writing, quote, some are saying that Mr. Bollinger's criticism was an unorthodox or even ungracious way of treating an invited guest. Others applauded the university president's remarks as a brave act of principle.
We're going to ask two Columbia students what they thought of it, provided they show up in a few moments. One of them was in the auditorium, and the other watched with classmates on monitors that were set up outside. First, though, let's get the rest of the news with Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, good morning, everyone. There's word this morning that military authorities in Myanmar are stepping up pressure on pro-democracy rallies there. 8 truckloads of armed riot police moved into the central city of Yangon today. Military leaders in Myanmar have warned over the past few days that they will take action to stop the protests that have swept the country for more than a week. But tens of thousands of Buddhist monks today defied that threat and continued marching through the country's biggest cities. Pro-democracy groups and ordinary citizens have also joined in the marches. Myanmar, also known as Burma, has been under military rule since the 1960s. Buddhist monks helped lead a pro-democracy uprising in 1988 that the military regime eventually crushed, killing 3,000 people in the process. President Bush is expected to call for sanctions against the military regime in Myanmar today during remarks to the UN General Assembly in New York. Union workers at General Motors go back on the picket lines today, the second day of a strike by the United Auto Workers against the car manufacturer. The strike is the first against GM in 30 years. It started late yesterday morning when 73,000 workers walked off the job in 80 GM facilities. Rex Britton of Lansing, Michigan was one of them. He's worked at GM for 27 years. He says GM's corporate management and CEO Richard Wagner left workers no choice but to strike.
For ever since I've hired in, they've gave stuff away that our fathers and grandfathers have fought for, and they want us to get lean and mean, and I think it's time Ricky gets lean and mean too. You know, these big wigs get all these big dollar bonuses, but they want the little man to take the cut.
The company says it needs to reduce its $5 billion annual health care bill and hire new workers at a lower wage in order to stay competitive in the global market. The union is pushing GM to keep more jobs in the U.S. Analysts say if the strike lasts longer than a week or two, it could cost GM billions of dollars. And could Microsoft and Facebook be signing on to become billion-dollar friends? Talks are said to be in the early stages, but analysts say Microsoft is considering investing in the social networking site, and the deal could make Facebook a $10 billion company. Google is also said to be plotting a stake in the fast-growing site, as well as several private equity firms. Facebook has more than 40 million members, up from 9 million last year. Analysts say if Google and Microsoft get into a competitive bidding situation, it could drive the value of Facebook even higher. And today's the big day for video gamers. The third installment of the Halo video game franchise for the Xbox 360 goes on sale today, Halo 3. With the tagline, "Finish the fight," the game picks up the saga of hero Master Chief, a helmeted super soldier of the future who returns to Earth in the middle of a battle for the survival of all mankind. The first shooter game costs about $60. A more expensive version of the game costs $130 and comes with a replica of the Master Chief helmet. That's the news.
I know it's on my Christmas list.
Yep.
Master Chief helmet. And then a date.
Good luck with that.
Thank you, Rachel Martin. Well, this Thursday night, Republican presidential candidates will be gathering at Morgan State University, a historically African-American college in Baltimore. They're gathering for a debate sponsored by PBS. It's geared towards black voters. There's just one hitch. None of the top GOP contenders will actually be there. Rudy Giuliani, John McCain, Mitt Romney, and Fred Thompson. They've all declined the invitation, which prompted the debate's leading moderator, TV and radio host Tavis Smiley, never one to mince words,
no,
Allison.
Very straightforward fella.
And in a very straightforward way, he said, quote, "No one should be elected president of this country in 2008 if they think that along the way they can ignore people of color." So we were wondering, are these candidates doing that or are they running a smart campaign? Joining us now to talk about it is Joe Watkins. He's a Republican strategist, former White House aide during the first President Bush's administration. Joe, thanks for coming on the Bryant Park Project.
Glad to be with you.
Well, as an African-American Republican yourself, what went through your mind when you heard that these candidates were going to skip this debate?
Well, I would agree with Tavis that nobody should be elected president who I guess doesn't consider people of color. I mean, people of color have made a huge contribution to the country and certainly deserve to be heard and certainly deserve to hear from their candidates. The flip side of that is that I've also worked in presidential campaigns, and I know certainly in this 2008 presidential cycle, these candidates have a lot of challenges. And the biggest challenge they have right now is time. Because they've only got basically till maybe February or March of next year, and then it's all over. We may know as early as February of next year who our nominee is going to be for the presidency, and if that's the case, they've only got a few months to really raise the requisite money to get their message out so they can win. If you don't win the primaries, by the way, you're no longer a candidate for the presidency. It's all over. So for these candidates to spend time talking to folks who might not be able to vote for them ends up not being in their best interest since they have so little time.
I guess my question, though, is that when will African Americans become Republican voters if the Republican candidates don't show up for things like this?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think that certainly in the general election, that is once the primary season is passed and we have a Republican nominee and a Democratic nominee, you'll see both those candidates working very, very hard to get everybody's vote. They'll be talking to African Americans and to Latino voters, to Americans of every kind, because they'll have to. And that'll be the real litmus test. Next year, when the invitations are made for folks to attend conventions or to give speeches or to take part in debates, it'll be a different story because we'll know our nominees and they'll have to talk to everybody. Right now, they've got limited time. The folks who would be nominee have limited time to raise the money they need to compete in a whole bunch of states at the same time. And believe me, if you don't have the money to compete, what's really going to be important and instructive to all of us is what happens at the end of this month when the FEC report comes out and tells us how much money the candidates have raised for their respective campaigns. And the ones that are going to be most competitive are the ones that have raised the most money. You're going to need money this time to compete in all those states at the same time. So they've got to be about that business first and foremost.
But it sounds a little bit like what you're saying is the candidates don't need the African-American vote until they need it later on when they become the nominee, at which point then they'll start making nice. I mean, isn't that disingenuous?
No, I don't think it's disingenuous. The reality is that a lot of states have closed primaries. You can't vote if you're a registered, for instance, independent or a registered Democrat or a registered Republican, then you've got to vote in that primary in some states. Which is to say that a lot of people are going to be disappointed who maybe have given money to, let's say, a candidate like Barack Obama. Maybe they're a first-time political, first-time voter, and they've given their money to Barack Obama, and they want to vote for him, and they're registered independent, and they find out that come primary they can't vote for him because they're not a registered Democrat, so they can't vote in the Democratic primary. This is the challenge that all the candidates face, and they know this. They know that the only people that can vote for them in the primaries are people who are in their party, so they've got to really tend to the people who are in their party to try to win those votes before they win the votes of people who can vote for them in the general.
You know, Republicans have said that they have really made an attempt to sort of reach out to African Americans in recent times. Can you cite any specific examples of that, things you think the Republicans have done that have actually showed their interest in the quality of life for African Americans?
I think Republicans have to do more, have to work a lot harder. But I know Ken Mellman, certainly the last Republican national chairman, worked very, very hard, went to a lot of African-American universities, colleges and universities, went to a number of the conventions, spoke to groups around the country just to cite how he felt and how he knows the Republican Party feels. And then the president certainly has made a statement by virtue of the number of African-Americans he appointed to his cabinet, I think an all-time high with regards to not just number, but also the quality of the positions that African-Americans have held in this administration. Two African-American secretaries of state, that's never been done in American history. An African-American secretary of housing and urban development, African-American national security advisor, and the list goes on and on. An African-American Secretary of Education. These are good signs, but the party has to work a lot harder. There's some good things to tout and some challenges yet and still that remain with the party. But
Joe, if I could just – we have just a few seconds left, but you're the pastor of a large African-American congregation in Philadelphia.
I am.
What do your parishioners say about voting Republican? Do they think you're crazy?
Well, we don't – you know, this is an interesting thing. I don't talk about politics in the pulpit.
How novel.
I talk about Christ in the pulpit. And while most of the folks know that I happen to be a Republican, you know, I let them know that what I am first and foremost is a Christian, and I love my people, and I hope my people love me, and I'm their shepherd. So we don't talk about politics at church, and however they choose to vote is fine.
Joe Watkins, Republican strategist, former White House aide for the first President Bush, and also pastor in Philadelphia. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, our Columbia students are here. They've made it. I'm not sure they're entirely caffeinated, but we'll get them in the
they
studio.
They look pissed.
We'll get them in the studio to find out what they thought about Ahmadinejad at their campus. We're also going to play a report by the one, the only, Mike Pesca. His take on the U.S. dollar and the Canadian dollar being equal. It's the Pesca treatment coming up. You're listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Sudden burst of energy from our director there, Matt Martinez. Arms raised to the heavens. You're listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. That's the best thing I've seen all day.
Certainly the most energetic thing I've seen all day. I'm Luke Burbank. Well, now it's time for one of my most favorite parts of our program, partly because we don't have to talk, Allison.
Nah.
Part of why this is awesome. But
chilling
also
like Bob Dylan.
Because we like to bring you the most emailed, talked about, blogged about news on the web with the help of our fearless producers and our editor. First off, we've got Dan Pashman here. Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good, good. Where's your story from?
It's most viewed on the LA Times website. And it's all about, you guys know how the Apple iPhone, people are hacking into their iPhones to get them to work on other networks because they're supposed to only work with AT&T. Well, Apple has issued this warning saying, first of all, if you hack your phone in this way, the warranty is null and void, which you would expect. But then they're also saying, you know, they send these periodic software updates to the phones. They're saying, you know, hey, if we send a software update to your phone and your phone's been hacked and it somehow happens to just make your phone completely useless, no bad on us. Sorry about that.
Ooh, yeah. that's a veiled threat.
Right.
Or not so veiled threat.
Yeah, so it's just sort of a little bit of strong arming there by Apple. But actually, interestingly, Luke, hackers are ready for this. They say they have ready software-based responses to any attempt by Apple to relock the modified phones. So,
game on.
Yeah, exactly.
Game on.
I challenge thee, sir.
All right, next most is...
Hey, Dan, when you go back in the other room, have Matt put a clock up, will you? That would really help.
Another prima donna moment by Luke.
All right, Tricia, do you want to go next? Because MJ is getting in the seat.
Yeah, I'll go next. This is the number two news, and I'm doing the finger quotes here, the number two news story on dig.com, which is one of those, you know, everybody digs a story and it gets there. So it's kind of like a user-generated... This is we decide what news is. But this is a really cool story from back in 2005. It's photos, which, who knows, they could be photoshopped, of a donkey attacking and killing a mountain lion. Yes, yes. It's apparently a story about a Montana couple going out riding, and their dogs had dogs with them, and they were on a mule, and a mountain lion came, tried to attack the dogs, and the donkey apparently fought back, according to this story.
It was a badass?
That's what the headline was. I didn't know if I could say that word on the radio. As the lion approached the dogs, the mule snatched him up by the tail and started whirling him around, banging its head on the ground on every pass. Then he dropped it, stomped on it, and held it to the ground by the throat. It goes on.
Things that I find suspect about this story, having looked at the photos, and by the way, we got to put the photos up on the blog so people can judge for themselves. Things that I found suspect. First of all, these people would be out riding a mule. That doesn't sound comfy. Second of all, a mule is killing a mountain lion, and you're like taking pictures of it from 5 feet away. And
but
then
they're
also,
cool pictures.
They are cool pictures, but my something detector says.
Hey, it's
says,
big on dig.
Okay. All right. You win. MJ Davis.
Hi, guys.
Hi there. You've got something for us. Where's this from?
I've got something about cupcakes from the New York Times most emailed list. Ooh, thanks. How do you like me now?
Better.
So apparently cupcakes are the big issue now in schools. There's federal legislation, there's state legislation saying you can't bring sweets to school, you can't bring cupcakes to school, and the PTAs, no likey.
Well, because everyone can agree too much sugar, kids overweight, but then cupcakes are the they're the centerpiece of grade school. They're the reason you go to school because you know on Friday it's someone's birthday and there's going to be cupcakes, you're going to play heads up, 7 up.
That's why I come to work some days.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and what's happening is the nutritionists are saying that cupcakes are the deal breaker. And there was actually a legislation that passed in Texas in 2005 called the Safe Cupcake Amendment, allowing cupcakes to be brought into your schools. And some of the quotes in this article are hilarious. They're like, everybody cups a cupcake and they make you so popular.
It was great. The graphic was great. It had a cupcake and one side was like a little angel and one side a little devil's horn. So cupcakes. My favorite story, my most, is from the most trusted name in news, CNN. Hungary issues entrepreneurial permits to prostitutes. The effort is to bring the prostitutes into the legal economy, so they're going to allow them to apply for entrepreneurial permits, and as a part of this permit, they can give people receipts.
Oh, yeah.
So when you do that expense report, when you're traveling in Hungary, you can try to write off your trip to the local prostitute, apparently.
Do you know that that's how, talk about value added, do you know that that's how Jerry Springer was once the mayor of Cincinnati,
right?
Which wasn't an elected position. He was on the city council, and it rotated into him being the mayor. But he wrote a bad check to a prostitute, and when it bounced, she reported him, and that was why he was removed as the mayor of Cincinnati. Just a little factoid from Luke's brain.
Should balance your checkbook.
That's right. That's right.
Lesson learned. So that's the most for today. Our most yesterday, we brought you a story about the Canadian loonie being on the rise. Loony is slang for the Canadian dollar because there's a little picture of a loon on the currency.
Yeah, absolutely. I learned how to blow. Let me blow a loon sound for you. I learned this at Loon Lake. Just on the subject of loons. This is our last pilot. I'm getting kind of – I'm losing it a little bit.
That was downright odd. Okay, for the first time in decades, the Canadian dollar equals the American dollar. And NPR's Mike Pesca spent some time talking with actual Canadians. Can I get the loon sound again?
Sure.
About what it means to be at parity with Americans, fiscally at least.
A year ago, if a Canadian offered you a penny for your thoughts, you'd have been more than justified in laughing in his frost-encrusted face. Such was the weakness of the Canadian dollar, or the loon, against the American dollar, or the dollar. But now, the weakness of the American dollar has brought trading levels to an even keel. For the first time in 31 years, the loonie, so named for the waterfowl depicted on the Canadian dollar coin, is worth $1 American. The toonie, so named for the tuna fish sandwich the Queen of England is depicted as eating, is worth $2. You see where we're going with this. A Canadian nickel with a beaver on its back, worth the same as an American nickel with Monticello on its back. One coin shows a work of architectural and engineering genius, which housed the greatest Renaissance man this continent has ever known. The other shows a river rodent, and yet somehow they're equally valued. John Moore is president of the Canadian Association of New York, which today is probably worth the same as the New York Association of Canada.
For at least my generation, we always knew that something was going to happen, but that happened this quickly, I think it has come as a surprise, but it's come as a very pleasant surprise.
Listen to him, the reasonableness fairly dripping from his inoffensive lips. And what exactly is this fifth column they call the Canadian Association?
The Canadian Association of New York is an association that has a rich history. We've been in New York City for over 100 years.
Which is like 89 Canadian? But no, those jokes aren't funny anymore. Or, more accurately put, they're both now unfunny and inaccurate. The Strung Loon isn't only a story of losers. I mean, there are suddenly wealthy Canadian tourists descending on the U.S. I fear they are already among us. As with any import-export story, dollar parities mean some benefit and some are hurt. But when the countries in question are the U.S. and Canada, all the usual equations come with an asterisk, which to our Canadian listeners is like a maple leaf, only smaller and off to the side. Mark Chandler, chief currency strategist for Brown Brothers Harriman, points to the interconnectedness of the two countries.
Much of what Canada exports are commodities. Most of those commodities are priced in U.S. dollars.
One big commodity that Canada exports is oil. But half of the oil flowing out of Canada is already owned by foreign companies, so the strength of the loon doesn't have a huge effect. Add it all up, and you come to see why a money man like Chandler regards the Canadian dollar as the pair of sensible brown loafers in the currency closet.
The sexier markets, the more glamorous markets, would be, of course, the euro, the yen, and sterling. A Canadian dollar is sort of it tends to be a very low volatile currency.
Don't tell John Moore about low volatility. He was jumping out of his skin in his moderate, gracious Canadian way.
This is a dramatic event for Canada and for Canadians, and I think we have a lot of nationalistic pride, and we're extremely happy that this has happened. And I think it's quite a topic among Canadians.
Well, of course it is. Hockey season hasn't started yet, which leads me to a thought. With their currencies at parity, maybe this is an opportunity for the U.S. and Canada to engage in some serious trade talks. Canada could buy back the Phoenix Coyotes, and the U.S. can throw in Celine Dion to sweeten the deal. The U.S. gets to keep Saturday Night Live alum Mike Myers, but Dan Aykroyd gets repatriated. Whatever trade imbalances result can be solved with a few Prince Edward Island muscles and an agreement between both nations to never let Alan Thicke host a talk show again. Unless, of course, the dollar gets stronger, then everything's ours. Except for the Celine Dion part, consider her a gesture of goodwill.
Proud to be an American. That was NPR's Mike Pesca. At Columbia University, about 600 or so people got to sit in an auditorium and see the president of Iran. Many more were on the lawn outside watching on some big screens. Ahmadinejad wasted no time in confirming his place as a controversial figure. Among the gems from yesterday's speech is assertion, no gay people in Iran. He spoke about how some big countries want to keep smaller ones from having nuclear capabilities and asked, why aren't all forms of research about the Holocaust acceptable? There to hear it in person were Columbia University student Seth Berliner, senior urban studies major from Chicago. You watched it on the lawn, right, Seth?
Yep.
Okay, and Andrew Avorn?
Avorn,
there you go. Senior political science major from Brookline. You were actually in the auditorium. Thanks, you guys, for getting on the one or two train and hauling it down here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, Andrew, from inside the auditorium, what was most impressive about Ahmadinejad, and then what was least impressive?
Well, I really liked his gesture, which is a sort of, it's a wave with the palm facing towards the speaker. It's very dictator-esque of him to do. Also, what was most impressive about the presentation in general was President Bullinger's excoriating introduction, which I really, it was enthralling. And that was by far the best part of the whole event.
What about for you, Seth?
I'd say Bollinger's opening remarks were impressive. The least impressive part, I thought, was Ahmadinejad. He came off sort of nutty, and his opening speech came out of left field. It was about the intersection of science and faith.
What about physically? Was he an imposing figure in any way physically?
I hate to say this, but he actually looks kind of like a nice guy. He has this goofy grin on his face when this man was probably hearing things he had never heard in prison, because I'm sure you're dragged off to prison if you say those things about Ahmadinejad in Iran. But he was just sitting there laughing as he was told that he was a petty and cruel dictator. So that was a little eerie, but no, he actually looks like a somewhat nice guy.
Did you have certain expectations, Seth, before you went into this, and were they met?
Yes and no. I definitely did not see Bollinger's remarks coming at all.
he had said that one of the conditions was that he would be challenging to President Ahmadinejad, but he was much more than challenging, borderline insulting, which was impressive.
That's what I was actually wondering about, though. You said borderline insulting. When I actually listened to what Bollinger said, it seemed to me like it was – I mean, you couldn't call it a sneak attack because Ahmadinejad had to know that he was going to get some grief. But it was like you invite the guy there and then you spend 10 or 15 minutes just totally excoriating him. Was there a sense that it was kind of a – that was a little unfair?
I think what's unfair is to supply weapons to Hamas and Hezbollah and to be arming arming terrorists against the United States troops in Iraq. And so he got whatever was coming to him. And, I mean, this is not Iran. As somebody said, when you invite somebody into your tent in Iran, you're expected to treat a guest with respect. We're not in Iran. We're on a Columbia – we're on a college campus at Columbia. And President Bollinger really got a great media coup because of this, because you look at all the coverage and it now says Ahmadinejad schooled on Fox News, whereas Columbia used to be getting a lot of flack for inviting him in the first place.
Do you think the president of – it's interesting. We're actually talking more about the president of Columbia than the president of Iran.
That's exactly how he wants it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Did you – Seth, in any way, did Ahmadinejad say anything to you that made sense in any way that you thought, okay, I may not agree with it, but I see how he got to that point?
Yes. I thought actually, though his opening remarks came out of left field, they were interesting and thought-provoking. And also his, well, I don't know, his statement about whether how to resolve the Israel-Palestine question, while I don't agree with it and it was a dodge of the actual question he was asked, made some sense, and I think there was a sense from a lot of people on campus that he was right in what he said.
What part of it?
That it should be resolved by the people who live there.
You were outside, Seth. You were sitting with a big group of people, I guess?
Yeah.
And what were people doing? Were they just – because inside it was pretty vociferous, but outside I have to imagine it was even more. Were people like doing the wave or throwing things at the TV?
I didn't see either waves or TVs.
All right,
but it
0 for 2, that's fine.
It was the largest gathering of Columbia students I've ever seen, bigger than a football game, anything. That's what gets our school spirit riled up. But there were people smoking hookah and having picnics, and there were a group of guys with Ahmadinejad Fest 07 t-shirts cheering the whole time and clapping.
Someone will always make a t-shirt.
Wait,
it doesn't matter what the event
Were they
is.
Cheering for him or against him?
I think the cheering was mostly just for the event.
It was ironic cheering?
Yeah.
Andrew, did you care about Iranian politics before this event, or did this cause you to go research it more? Or?
Well, I founded a group last year called Pro-Israel Progressives, a group of liberal students who support Israel. And so, yes, Iran is the most significant issue in the Middle East right now. And so I was actually – the way I was part of the 600 to actually sit in the speech was President Bollinger's secretary sent an email to a list of student leaders who in turn forwarded it to all of their friends. So the current president of my club forwarded the email to me, and that's how I came to be there. But I think that for Columbia in general, it did awaken an interest in Iran, and it's a good interest to have because, as I said, like this is the most significant academic issue of study in the world today, and people have to understand it, if for no other reason than for, you know, President Bush to drum up support for the coming invasion, which I hope he's not trying to do, and I hope that this was not part of that effort. In fact, I think it was just the opposite.
As you were walking in there, Andrew, did you feel like I am going to witness history?
Well, you know what? If, God forbid, there is some sort of attack on Americans by or supported by Iran, then yes, I would have been part of an unfortunate part of history. But I think that right now, President Bollinger and Columbia look great because, yes, he's a significant Ahmadinejad is a significant world leader, but right now the ball is in our court.
Seth, was this something that took over the campus in terms of conversation, just wherever you went, whether it's the dining hall or went to the library, just the murmur of it?
Definitely. It got a little tiring in the lead-up to the event, but I think the event lived up to its billing, and not only Ahmadinejad's
specific speech and Bollinger's remarks, but also the whole day was really, it was almost a festival holiday off from classes atmosphere. The lawns were filled with people and College Walk and the steps were the scenes of some great protesting and counter-protesting. And it wasn't just limited, I think, to Ahmadinejad. There was a guy carrying around a sign that said, two robots in every garage.
I love what protesters bring out everybody.
Yeah. And so it was really, it was a lot of fun. And I think it's sort of, there was, I think anybody who was tired of hearing about it was sort of relieved to see that it lived up to all that hype.
Can I ask you guys a question that's actually off the topic of Colombia? What did you think about Ahmadinejad laying a wreath at Ground Zero? Personally, what did you guys think of that?
I think if President Ahmadinejad wants to lay a wreath, that's fine. But I think it was wise of the NYPD not to let him do that. I think it would have caused a lot of people a lot of trouble, and I think it probably would have shut down Lower Manhattan for a day.
How about you,
just
Andrew?
Seeing all the security that Colombia had, we had, they may have been revolutionary guardsmen, we had Secret Service, hundreds of police officers, every single security personnel at Colombia was deployed for this event. And so it would have been a terrible inconvenience. But also symbolically, President Bollinger was very effective in not allowing this to be a media opportunity, a publicity stunt for Ahmadinejad. And I'm sure that he had wanted it that way. And so if he wanted to bring his own security, that's fine. But I don't know if New York City and the NYPD should have spent the millions and millions of dollars necessary to let Ahmadinejad basically connect directly to the American people, for better or for worse.
Seth, if you could have asked a question yesterday, what would it have been?
I think I would have wanted to press him a little more on his Holocaust denial. Mm-hmm. The question he was asked was a little too vague for me, and I think somebody should have asked him straight up or down, does he believe the Holocaust occurred? And gotten
he said
a straight answer.
He said he wouldn't answer a yes or no question. Somebody said they just wanted a yes or no answer.
Right. Well, that was to the Israel question, and he dodged it, and then Dean Coatsworth asked for a yes or no answer, and he dodged it again. And I think, again, with that, I would have liked to see a different question asked, which would have been, do you stand by your statement that Israel should be wiped off the map?
And Andrew, with just about a minute left, if you could have asked a question, what would it have been?
It would have been, how many Jews, if any, died in the Holocaust? Give me a number.
You know what his answer would have been.
Well, I don't, because he would have dodged it.
Well, exactly. That would have been his answer. Yeah. Well, you guys, thank you so much for waking up early. We really appreciate you sharing your experience yesterday. It sounds like it was kind of awesome. Doesn't necessarily the right word, but probably was the right word, because it's probably really, really interesting to be there.
It was invigorating.
Yeah.
It was invigorating.
Andrew and Seth, both students at Columbia, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, coming up on the Bryant Park Project, as we draw to a close our final pilot show, Allison, we will talk to one of the stalwarts of the piloting process. when no one else was listening, before time, there was Steve Peterson, and we've ginned up a special award for him. By the way, he started out not liking the show.
Yeah, he really didn't.
We'll
think
ask him what he
us.
Thinks of it now, now that he's getting an award.
You're listening to the Bryant Park Project on NPR News. You're listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart, along with my partner in crime, Luke Burbank. We all know visual presentation is extremely important, especially in a presidential campaign. We're going to be talking about that in just a little bit.
Also, for better or worse, starting out with the worse, some people who were having a romantic interlude in New York that was interrupted quite rudely. They're here in the studio to tell us about it coming up in a few minutes. First, though, let's get today's top stories from our newscaster, Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Japan has a new prime minister this morning. The Japanese parliament elected Yasuo Fukuda as the country's new leader. 71-year-old Fukuda took over from Shinzo Abe, a nationalist who lasted barely a year in office after a series of damaging scandals and his party's loss in parliamentary elections last July. Fukuda is a veteran moderate politician and the son of a former prime minister. And you might have heard, protests are expected again today in New York as Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad prepares to speak at the UN's General Assembly. Yesterday, the Iranian leader was the guest speaker at Columbia University. Students there gathered and railed against the leader's denial of the Holocaust and Iran's record on human rights. Ahmadinejad has also drawn fire for Iran's nuclear program, which U.S. and European leaders say could be used to create a nuclear weapon. In his remarks yesterday, the Iranian president insisted that Iran has always cooperated with the International Atomic Energy Agency, or the IAEA.
We are one of the countries that's carried out the most amount of level of cooperation with the IAEA. They've had hours and weeks and days of inspections in our country. And over again, the agency's reports indicate that Iran's activities are peaceful, that they have not detected a deviation.
Ahmadinejad, speaking through a translator, went on to say that Iran wants to negotiate with the U.S. and other nations. And at the end of his talk, he invited all those in attendance to come visit Iran. And for the first time in more than 30 years, an American power company is asking permission to build two new nuclear power plants. The company NRG Energy, based in New Jersey, is applying for a license from the federal government to start work on two nuclear facilities in Texas. It's a move experts say signals a revived interest in nuclear power, spurred by high prices for natural gas, high demand for electricity, and the desire for more American independence from oil. And it's about 2,500 Latin words on one page of very old paper. It's the foundation for the legal systems and ethos of British and American societies. It's the Magna Carta, and now it could be yours. A 13th century copy of this historic document is going up for sale. Sotheby's Auction House is expected to make the formal announcement today. The Auction House says this is the only copy of the Magna Carta in the U.S., and it happens to be owned by Texas billionaire and former presidential candidate Ross Perot. The document goes on the auction block in December, and it's expected to fetch between $20 and $30 million. Luke and Allison, get out your checkbooks. Halo 3, Magna Carta, lots of things to put on your Christmas list this year. That's the news. You can always find it at npr.org. I'm Rachel Martin. Back to you, Luke Nelson.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you, Rachel. You're so, welcome. Luke, you know how hard it was for us to find a logo for our show.
Yes.
We went through a big process, taking a look at, do we like the graphic? Do we like the color? Do we like the placement? What does it say about us?
Right, right.
Can you imagine being a presidential candidate and having to pick your logo, your bumper sticker, your button?
If I did, I think my font would be Comic Sans. I don't know how that would go over, but
I think that actually might be appropriate. You never know. We are going to talk to somebody who has actually spent time dissecting the candidates' logos, whether you have to use red, white, and blue, stars and stripes all the time. He's a graphic designer named Ryan Bowman. He has spent a lot of time looking at logos. He analyzed them for Good Magazine. He joins us on the phone from London. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So we're going to tell our listeners that they can play along. Go to the Bryant Park Project at NPR, and you can take a look at some of these logos. But first, overall, big picture, when you start examining a political logo or bumper sticker, what exactly are you looking for?
Well, I guess the interesting thing to me about these logos is that I think, personally, that they're just as important as a stump speech. So I look for sort of instantaneous communication. So, for instance, like a Hillary Clinton logo, which I think is probably the best of the bunch, it immediately says to me, you know, Hillary, first name basis. You know, it has an amazing sort of serif font that's perfectly placed. It has the nice sort of stylized flag. You know, all these things instantly communicate something to me, and that's what I look for.
So you immediately need to know who the candidate is and what they stand for. You can figure that out through the logo?
Yeah, I think we all do. I think we're sort of trained to do that. Every day we sort of are constantly approached by these images, and you make instantaneous judgments on them. Not by in some conscious process that, you know, this is specifically placed here, this is specifically placed there. It just sort of happens to you. It just happens in the back of your mind, and you make that judgment instantaneously.
Nearly every candidate's logo has red, white, and blue. That seems to be generically the only colors.
That's how you know they're American.
Allowed. Is that right? Is that the rule? You have to use red, white, and blue, or has anybody stepped out on the edge a little bit?
Well, the only person who has stepped on the edge in this sort of presidential cycle is John Edwards, really, and he has a green sort of swoosh coming out of his name. And unfortunately, it's probably the worst part of any logo. It just sort of looks like Shrek was there and sort of, you know, colored out in a little bit. But this is a sort of modern tradition, the red, white, and blue. In the past, in the sort of like 60s and 70s, people were more adventurous. They would use green and yellow, you know, get crazy, not use a star and things like that.
Now, I know you're not a fan of the Barack Obama logo. Let me try to explain to people. They tried to use negative space a little bit. There are no edges. It says Obama 08. And then there's sort of an O, which looks like the landscape and the ground would be like fields, is a red and white flag. Tell me why, in your opinion, this does not work.
Well, I sort of applaud the attempt to be different, but unfortunately, it just looks empty to me. The O on the top doesn't really express O in you know, in any sort of real way. And also, the font itself is really, you know, persnickety, and it's actually named Perpetua, which is probably the worst name for a font.
Oh, that's the name of the font?
Yeah, and I'm sure they picked it just for that reason, didn't they? You know, the only font that would have been better is a font named Hope or something like that.
John McCain's is really interesting because it really telegraphs his personal history. Can you describe the McCain logo for us?
Well, the McCain logo is really sort of militaristic. It has his name in a really simple sans serif font, but on top it has this really militaristic star, which each half of the point is colored in, so it looks like, you know, any badge that you would see on a military uniform, and it has two yellow points sticking out as, you know, going past and future. And it actually, the people who design this usually design defense marketing, Department of Defense marketing material. So they've purposely tried to be, you know, associate McCain with that strong personality and the support of the war that he's become infamous for.
You've got to give it up for late entry Alan Keyes on the Republican side. His sign is the only one that actually has something aside from his name. It just says, "We need Alan Keyes for president." He's just putting it right out there.
Is less more in terms of language on these things? You've got Joe Biden who just says, "Biden, president." He's already making the leap. He's president. What about text? I mean, is there such thing as too much or too little?
Yeah, I mean, the only problem with it is if you go too sparse like Rudy Giuliani, you just sort of look, and Rudy Giuliani is probably the worst one. But, you know, it's good. You want to.
Although it just says Rudy. See, Rudy Giuliani's is just Rudy in huge letters.
It doesn't say anything about president, really. It just says Rudy.
No. It makes you think Notre Dame and chanting.
Ryan Bowman, graphic designer with Shake Up Media in London. You recently redesigned the Financial Times newspaper, so the man knows what he's talking about. Hey, Ryan, thanks for walking us through all that.
Thanks for having me.
Young love. Is there any better place for it than New York? You save your money, you get the ring, you take your beautiful lady to beautiful Central Park, you get down on bended knee in a gazebo, maybe you have some Boys to Men on the boombox.
No, definitely not.
Okay. The Boys to Men is sort of optional. Anyway, it's the perfect scene until a dude with a gun robs you This is precisely what happened to Luke Yasunsky and his now, we're happy to report, fiance, Mami Nagase, last Saturday night. Thankfully, they survived, as did their relationship. They are now here to talk to us. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Glad you guys made it okay. Tell me what happened exactly. You were proposing, Luke.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, amazing name. Congratulations
on
being named
much.
Luke. It's awesome.
Yeah,
you're on bended knee, and then what happens?
I propose, and then basically we sit down in the gazebo to talk to one another, and as soon as we sit down at the gazebo, not really a gentleman, but...
he's very kind of you.
Yeah.
Very polite person.
He comes out of the bushes and approaches us. I said, hey, to kind of, like, yell at him and let him know that I'm coming. And I was hoping that he'd actually say, like, oh, sorry, didn't mean to startle you and walk off. But, of course, that's not what happened. He came up, pulled out a gun, had us get down on the ground and, asked for all of our belongings, cash, jewelry, rings.
Mommy, what were you thinking? Were you terrified or?
Were you scared?
Yeah.
I can imagine.
And so did you have the ring on your finger, Mommy? The engagement ring? What happened when the guy tried to rob you? Yeah, scoot in there a little bit, Mommy, to the microphone. What happened? How did this ring make it into this radio studio, Luke? What happened?
Basically, when he was asking for our rings, give me the rings. I saw Mommy struggling to get the rings off her finger, and there was no way I wanted him to get the ring, the engagement ring at least, and. I acted like I was trying to help her get her rings off. I took the engagement ring off first, and then I acted like I was trying to help her get the other rings off, and he got frustrated and kind of shoved me away to say, hey, I'll get those myself. And when I was laying back on the ground on my back, I kind of tried to slide the ring in my pocket, and then he noticed that I was trying to do that, and he said, hey, what do you got in your hand there? And I said, I don't have anything. And I kind of crossed my arms at that point and dropped the ring on the ground and then put my left arm over it and then showed him my hands like, look, I don't have anything. And he's like, no, they're on the ground underneath your arm. And I was like, I kind of wiggled around and pushed the ring under my back. And I got it close to my right side and he shoved a gun in my stomach. And then,
oh, my God.
Yeah. And then he ripped my shirt and kind of flipped me over, but I had pushed it far enough on my right-hand side that when I flipped over on my side, he still couldn't see the ring, and I think he got nervous, basically.
I would have flown back to Seattle and gotten my mother's wedding ring and given it to this guy if that's what it took. I can't believe how brave you were.
Yeah, really.
You know what? Actually, my mom did give me a ring to give to Mommy. It took me a long time to find this ring, and it was very difficult because actually Mommy designs jewelry herself, and I was under a lot of pressure to actually come up with a really cool ring, and I finally found one, and this guy tries and rips it off. I was just like, nah, I don't think so.
So amazingly, you preserved the engagement ring. Is he your hero, Mommy? You must have been pretty proud of him for hanging onto the ring.
Please say yes.
Is that what you said after you proposed to her?
Yeah.
So then what did they actually get from you guys?
They got, tell them what they got from you.
My watch, my money, my...
Tell them about the watch, how important that was to you.
Yeah, my mom gave me.
Aww.
It was like a family heirloom.
Really?
Yeah, handed down generation to generation. So.
And you were about to go out to dinner. They took your dinner money?
Yep, yeah, took everything, all our cash, my credit cards. She lost a really important photo as well of a friend who passed away.
Oh, man.
And, yeah, those are the things that we were most concerned about, the watch and the photograph, because those are things you can't replace, obviously.
Passport.
Yeah, it took her passport,
What did you guys end up having for dinner?
Doritos at the cop precinct.
You had Doritos at the precinct?
Yep, it was very nice of them to give us something to eat.
Were the police kind of amazed at what you did?
Well,
if you told them the story, what did they say to you?
They're actually amazed that this happened in the first place. They said this kind of thing doesn't really happen in Central Park hardly ever anymore. So they were really shocked, actually, to hear that this kind of story happen. So
there's some sort of engagement bandit out there waiting for people.
Yeah.
Do you guys feel like, though, this has actually made the relationship a little stronger? I mean, not that you needed much help in that department. You were engaged, but just like you had this amazing story. You saved the ring heroically. You got your Doritos.
Maybe as time passes, I'm still trying to get over the fact that I almost feel bad about putting us in that situation. Because actually,
you shouldn't feel bad. Yeah. You didn't do a dang thing wrong.
Just Mommy, tell him not to feel bad. Tell him don't feel bad.
Feel bad.
Feel bad.
Okay, you guys.
Luke, it's not too late. Not too late.
I like a girl with a sense of humor.
Well, listen, Mommy Nagase and Luke Yasunski, you guys were very happy to see that you made it out in one piece and that your relationship survived. And very good luck going forward with your life.
Yes, we wish you really good things.
Here's to no more romantic encounters with robbers in Central Park.
Thank you
guys very, very much.
Take care to both of you. Okay, so Luke, so this was, we're wrapping up.
Yeah.
This is kind of, we're getting near the end of
I'm
big thing.
I'm getting a little bit kind of almost verklempt.
We have our huge debut on Monday, October 1st, mm-hmm, when we start to go on not just podcasting, but also on the radio.
Real, actual radio stations, Sirius satellite radio. You can hear us all over the country.
It's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. So we started this blog. This blog actually started even before I was hired on this project, when it was just you and Matt and a guy named Steve. You want to explain?
Well, we would, you know, put up these little bits and pieces of the show. We would do interviews, and we asked people to comment on them. And in the early days, let's just say there weren't a ton of people checking the blog, but there was one voice in the wilderness, one guy who would listen to everything we did and give us his thoughts on it, and his name was Steve Peterson. Now, let's read from his first blog post on April 11th, 2007. As an NPR addict in his mid-20s, I'm excited for the Bryant Park Project, a program geared towards me, but so far my feelings are mixed. As I've scanned through the blog posts so far, I find them funny, but it seems that Matt and Luke are trying too hard to be hip. While I've never met them before, I reckon they're hip, but the appearance of trying too hard will cause the project to fizzle.
And Steve Peterson has posted pretty much ever since that day.
Yes.
For the past how many months?
Steve, are you there?
I am here. And Luke, I think you're hip now, and you're not trying too much anymore.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear it. Well, Steve, we have a special award for you. We'll send you something on construction paper, but we want to present you with the Bryant Park Project Award for Meritorious Blog Commenting. Steve Peterson, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow, that makes us listen to all of these pilots worth it.
Steve, why did you listen to every pilot and comment on everything? You were our most devoted listener and our most specific blog poster.
Well, I like being, as I mentioned, I'm an NPR addict, so I guess there's this more NPR to have. So, but also, it's just really fun to be part of something and help shaping something. This being Rough Cuts, you know, NPR's like, we're trying something new, comment on it. I felt like it'd be fun to be part of something, and I was actually quite involved with Tell Me More, Michelle Martin's show, that they went through Rough Cuts as well.
Yeah, but did they give you an award for meritorious blog commenting?
They didn't, but they did have me on one of their last pilots, like you have me as well, so.
Oh, seriously? See, every time we think we do something original, Tell Me More beats us to the punch.
Well, no, but you're giving me an award. So you guys definitely beat Michelle Martin. I'll have to email her and make her all mad or something. So.
Well, Steve Peterson.
I have two questions before we let you go. One is, what do you think that has improved the most since the project began? And what do we still need to work on?
Well, one, I think it's Allison. You came on. Also, I think you guys are feeling more comfortable now in the format. And I was explaining this to a friend last night, and trying to kind of have your top 40 radio show in the morning, but bringing like Morning Edition and trying to merge the two. And I think you guys have really found how to do that. Like last week you had two segments on clotheslines. I thought those were fascinating. It was conversational, it was funny, but at the same time you guys really went into the NPR treatment of it and pulled like the history out of it. You pulled the global warming connection type of thing out of it. So that was really cool. And I think you guys have really found how to be conversational but be NPR at the same time. And in a
what do you think we can still improve on, Steve?
I think you guys, let's see, it's early in the morning and you guys are giving awards, so how can I be
That's fine. There's nothing we can improve on, I think, is what you're saying.
I'm just trying to think. I guess it would be nice, and you're probably going to do this next week, but it'd be fun if you break your segments up on blog.
Yes, that's actually being worked on at NPR Digital Headquarters right now.
Yeah, so it'd be easier to like kind of listen to you guys in snippets or tidbits. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but knowing how other programs are posted online, I think you guys are going to be working on that as well. So
yes, we are. And Steve, we just want to thank you again.
Seriously,
thank you for spending
so much time with us.
Thanks for listening.
We appreciate it. Steve Peterson, ladies and gentlemen.
Super blogger. Super poster.
Super poster, super listener, super guy,
thanks,
Steve
Allison.
Peterson.
All right, we're going to be real on Monday, Luke.
It is.
Real live grown-up radio show.
We are going to be real. Boy, this is exciting. And I like that we busted the last pilot.
Yeah.
Our last semi-pretend show, and we completely blew out the end of the program. But that's what pilots are for.
Let's give everybody props. Our staff includes Ilya Maritz, MJ Davis, Dan Pashman, Wynn Rosenfeld, Carrie Toby, and Rachel Martin.
She's our newscaster. Our senior producer slash director right now is Mr. Matt Martinez. Our editor, Tricia McKinney.
Sharon Hoffman is the executive producer of the Bryant Park Project.
I'm Luke Burbank. I'm a real boy.
Allison Stewart.
That's
debatable. Come visit our blog at npr.org/Bryant Park. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We will be a real radio show on October 1st, coming this Monday. We hope you join us.